The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We live in the age of the internet famous, the YouTube channel hosts with millions of followers, the Vine and Instagram stars who parlay viral moments into steady cash flows. But for every multi-million dollar web sensation, there are countless artists stuck in a sort of fame purgatory. As Gabby Dunn puts it, too visible to have real jobs, but too broke not to. And Gabby would know. She's one half of Just Between Us. That's a YouTube comedy channel starring herself and her friend Allison Raskin. They have 500,000 subscribers and put out 2 videos a week. But that does not mean they're on easy street. Gabby wrote the article, The Sad Economics of Being Famous on the Internet for Fusion. And Gabby, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
So if you don't mind me being so forward, how do you make money from your show?
That's okay that you're forward. I think that's something that more YouTubers and more people who make content on the internet need to talk about, how they're making money and who's paying what. We make money through YouTube, through AdSense, but the ads that play before videos, and also branded deals where companies will sponsor one video. But I think people have this idea that you're making so much money just through YouTube or just from the videos, and that's not the case. A lot of times the videos are what lead to other gigs, so freelance writing or acting gigs, or, you know, working with brands on their channels to make stuff for them that will never appear on our channel. So there's this idea that YouTube itself is giving content creators tons of money, and you can just work on YouTube and that's it. But that's not the case. It leads to paying gigs.
Yeah, that was kind of my impression, that, you know, someone was internet famous, they were making some bank. That's not your story.
No, I mean, you can have a ton of Instagram followers, but until you monetize that in the sense of, like, posting a video of you holding a box of autumn goodies that this company wants you to hold, then you're not going to make money just by posting to your, you know, 340,000 fans on Instagram. You have to turn that into something. But it's also this double-edged sword because fans hate that.
You told so many stories in this article of people who, very much like you, exist in this kind of middle ground between fame and financial success. So tell us some of those stories.
Sure. The beginning of the article starts with a friend of mine, Brittany Ashley, who works for BuzzFeed, which is a huge company, and now she's there full time. But before she was there full time, she was an actress on their channel, getting paid $100, $200 for one-off videos. And she appeared in a lot of videos for them. And BuzzFeed has 17 million subscribers, so she was one of the most well-known faces there. But since she wasn't hired full-time and she was just getting paid for one-off videos, she needed also to have a full-time job. So she worked at a restaurant, and she would get recognized often at brunch and stuff. Often the kids would be very confused as to why this person that they watch on their computer and see as famous is working at a restaurant. BuzzFeed Golden Globes party was at her restaurant, so she was working serving the people that she also acted opposite.
So she was waiting tables at the restaurant where they were having this celebratory party. People thought she was faking.
Yeah, they thought she was doing a comedy bit. But she was like, no, I work here.
She's got enough fame currency to be recognized, but not enough real currency, I guess, to pay her rent.
Yeah. And then she eventually, I mean, this is her story, but she eventually, like, put her foot down to BuzzFeed, and now she works there full time. But the other situation is, like, this girl, Rachel Whitehurst, who was working at a Starbucks in Seattle, and she was making videos, and she had fans memorize her schedule at Starbucks and show up all the time to bother her at work. And so she eventually had to quit working there.
What do you think, Gabby, that's any different for social media stars than maybe actors who may make a living doing, or half a living doing, commercials, or musicians who aren't quite famous enough to stop waiting table? I mean, this middle ground success, is this a product of the internet age, do you think?
I think it is, because it's more, it causes things to be more widespread. You can have a huge number of fans all over the world who don't have to come to the performance. The performance is you posting it on the internet. They don't have to come to the cafe to see you. I mean, often people don't look up the actors in things. Like, I have friends who are on HBO shows who have less subscribers to their YouTube or less Twitter followers than I do, because I think the fans see me on their computer and then follow me naturally to other things on their computer. Hmm. But if you like an actor in a show, you're not necessarily going to like their Twitter as well.
That's interesting. So if you see someone on a show, I mean, you don't have the same kind of access or, I think, sense of intimacy. How do you think that plays into it?
Oh, completely. There's an actress that Allison and I love, and we love her performance on this show. We think she's wonderful. And then we both had to stop following her on Instagram because she would just post about Jesus all the time. And we were like, it's not the same. Like, we're not following the character from the show that we love. Whereas on YouTube, it is intimate because you're playing, quote unquote, yourself.
You and Allison did a sketch for your show, and it's called Don't Read the Comments. And, of course, the whole idea is that you're trying to film an episode of your YouTube show, but you keep stopping because you're both obsessed with all the critical feedback people have given you. So let's hear just a clip from that.
Action.
Gabby, I can't believe this.
Cut. Allison, why are you talking like that?
Oh, some people say that my voice is too high-pitched, so I wanted to make it more relatable and less grating.
I have some notes on the script, actually.
You wrote the script. We're halfway through the script.
Yeah, but I was going through my Tumblr mentions, and people seem to find the Gabby character too aggressive, so I want to try to be a little less divisive.
But that's your whole thing. You're divisive and the sexually aggressive one.
Oh, can you see this? The label?
Spin it.
I don't want people to think that we're secretly trying to sell them Trader Joe's water.
One, two, check.
How could you not do that?
Sorry, people get really upset when the audio quality is bad.
Mm-hmm. Number one complaint.
That's Allison Ruskin and my guest Gabby Dunn from Just Between Us, their YouTube show. Well, Gabby, you talk in your article about stars have to be careful about being perceived as sellouts, something that you sort of knock on right there in that little clip. How does that happen?
People seem to get very upset when you start monetizing your following. But I think it's because they think of it as greedy and they don't realize that it's getting paid to do a job that you've been doing for free. We'll get comments like, stop with the promotion, stop with the sponsorships. But Allison and I have been making two videos a week for free for 2 years. So there's, you know, 110 unsponsored videos that you could watch that are free. And we've made maybe 5 sponsored videos.
So do any of your followers, your many followers, pay for the videos? Do they support you financially?
Some of them do, yeah. There's a website called Patreon that is wonderful. I mean, the content is free. We would make the content for free. They're not paying to see anything, but they're paying as sort of like a one-person sponsorship. So Patreon's been a really good way for creators to make money because the fans will support them directly. However, in the article, I mentioned that a lot of times there's a push to support small YouTubers, which is like people with 10K followers or people with, you know, 5 or 20K followers. But Allison and I have over 500,000. So people didn't realize that this is a channel that they would need to support. There's no metric for what a big YouTuber is and what a small YouTuber is. It used to be you hit 1 million and you're golden. But now people have 7 million, 12 million. Like, 1 million doesn't mean as much as it used to.
It's so interesting, though, that you're to have the support of your fans, you have to appear poor, for lack of a better word. I mean, you can't be making money on this, but yet you can't continue to do it without any money.
Yeah, and we also, our channel is a sketch comedy channel, and we post very often, way more often than a lot of channels do. So we have more overhead than, let's say, a person posting a vlog once a week would. We bit ourselves in the butt about that because we just wanted to do high quality, like, scripted content, and that takes money. So we pay our crew, and we buy clothes and costumes and stuff like that, and that's, you know, we could just... I don't know that the channel would be as successful if it was just us in front of a camera talking into like a shoddy camera. But even those people, they have to buy better lights, buy better sound equipment. Like, each type of person making stuff on the internet has their own overhead.
So what would be success in your eyes? Is it purely financial benchmark, or do you have other goals in mind?
Well, a lot of YouTubers want to just be YouTubers. And it's very interesting because, you know, young fans will say, I want to be a YouTuber when I grow up. And that's not really what you mean. Like, Allison and I want to write a television show. We want to make a sitcom based on us. And so that was sort of always the goal of the channel. And Allison and I used to work for BuzzFeed. And we would get young people saying to us, I want to work at BuzzFeed. My dream is to work at BuzzFeed. And I would always say, no, your dream is to work in video production. Your dream is to produce television or films. Like, you can't think of it as this company is the end game or making YouTube videos is the end game. These young people have to know that what they actually want is to write content, to be video producers. It's this disconnect that I don't think that they realize.
Well, Gabby Dunn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gabby Dunn, she's a comedian and a writer, and she's internet famous for her YouTube channel. It's called Just Between Us. You'll find a link to read her article, The Sad Economics of Internet Fame, which she wrote for Fusion. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. They are the most literal signs of desperation. Cash for your gold. We buy ugly houses. And for those in the upper crust, cash for your Warhol. Quick settlements, no questions asked. That sign began popping up in American cities during the Great Recession. The prank slash art installation is now a fake business with a real storefront and genuine competition. I'll let Jeff Hargadon, he's a conceptual artist, financial advisor, and the brains behind Cash for Your Warhol, explain. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, but what a great story here. This Cash for Your Warhol thing, it's been going on since 2009. What started it for you?
Well, we were in the middle of the financial crisis, and I kept seeing so many of these signs, cash your house, cash for this and that, everywhere. It seemed like an assault on our senses from all telephone poles all over. It just popped in my head one time, what about the 1%? What about their liquidity needs? And the phrase cash for your Warhol just popped in my head. I thought, well, I think I'm just going to make a bunch of signs and see what happens.
So people called you?
Oh, yeah. The first set of signs that I did actually had my mobile number on it, which was a mistake. I thought everybody would be in on the joke, but no, not everybody was. I eventually migrated to a Google Voice number where all the calls are archived.
Mm. I go to your website and it says, Cash for Your Warhol has been business for several months.
That needs to be updated, I guess.
But it says it will help you manage your finances, increase liquidity, manage child support obligations, and get on with your life. So people were called. Were they in on the joke?
There were the calls that I get are curiosity seekers. They are people who just want to know if it's a real number, the people who want to talk about the project. And I get a surprising amount of people who actually have Warhols that they want to sell.
Really? Well, so is that the measure of success for you, how many people you fool?
I'm not sure how to define success with this project. For me, it's just being part of a broader conversation about art and art as commodity, and it's a little bit anti-establishment. It's really about how art has been commodified. And the more people talk about that, the more successful it is. But I'm really not trying to fool people. That's why I put my cell phone number on there on the first sign. I figured everybody would get it.
And now you have a storefront. So what's in there?
Well, the store is designed in such a way that for people who have Warhols that they want to bring in and sell, they now have a place to go. We're exclusively dealing in Warhols. And the way the store is set up is it's meant to look very much like a pawn shop. It's also really an art installation that can be viewed from the sidewalk. So while I'm not there, people can walk by and pretty much see the whole thing.
I noticed that I was looking at photographs on the Boston Globe. They had a little slideshow of the store. And their fake checks, you made out cash for your Warhols, made out to people.
Are
I'm assuming they're fake. Let's put it that way.
Well, I will say this. Some of the stuff in the store is real and some of it is not real. And I leave it up to the viewer to decide what's what.
Well, now you have competition, apparently. As I was looking you up online, there are other Cash for Your Warhol businesses that are being set up.
That is right. Friends of mine were Googling Cash for Your Warhol and noticed that one site, Cash for Your Warhols, with an S at the end, had popped up. And the website is actually near replica of my site, except it's a real business. It's run out of California. I actually hired a lawyer to present them with a cease and desist order, not because I'm so mad, but because I thought it would be kind of fun for a fake business to try to stop a real business from, you know, imposing on my fake business. So, and it's actually worked. We just heard back from them recently. We're in the process of negotiating a settlement, and we're pretty pleased with the results. And in fact, the whole process of the cease and desist order might end up being another spin-off of the project.
Well, I was thinking that. I also read that there's going to be a show of the signs at a gallery, I think, in Philadelphia or something like that.
Yeah, and we actually was in April of 2015, we had a show of all the signs that have been designed at that point, and it was really fun to see them all on a wall, framed up, you know, all dressed up for the big show.
So, okay, so you've got a storefront now. You've actually got a cease and desist business against a real business for getting in the way of your fake business. Where, right. Where do you go from here, Jeff?
I don't know. My philosophy is if I have an idea and it sounds reasonably good, I'm going to put it out there and just see what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't really expect anything to be financially successful or critically acclaimed. If I have an idea, I want to throw it out and enjoy the process and kind of see where it goes. And this project has been, it's been amazing. Some of the things that have happened as a result of it. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't just made up that initial set of signs with my cell phone number on it and started putting them on telephone poles.
Mm.
So it's been really enjoyable.
So you're doing it. I mean, I can't help but think that Andy Warhol would think this is pretty funny.
Well, I never knew Andy, but people I know, I've come to know people who did know Andy Warhol, and they tell me that he would have enjoyed it.
Jeff Hargadon, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Hargadon, he's a conceptual artist and he's a financial advisor from Somerville, Mass. Cash for Your Warhol now has a storefront at Inman Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's much more on the store, including a slideshow that's from the Boston Globe. There's a link to that at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Biophilia refers to the instinctive affection that humans have for nature. It's a term that was coined in the mid-1980s by the renowned biologist E.O. Wilson. Since then, scientists have shown that spending time in green spaces reduces brain fatigue, helps kids handle stress, and improves overall physiology. For those who live in intensively urban environments, connecting with the natural world may provide a literal and figurative lifeline. This story, which comes to us from producer Ari Daniel, is about just such a connection.
At first glance, Rodney Stotts seems to be a man at odds with himself. But here's how I reconcile him, as a fierce thundercloud with the softest of silver linings. Let me explain. The thing to know about this man is that he's obsessed with animals.
This is where I live, actually.
We're in Maryland, about halfway between Baltimore and D.C.
This is Gaddy and Gonix. Move! Don't jump up on everybody. Two pit bulls, American pit bulls.
He's got four chickens and five rabbits.
The rabbits, I ended up getting attached to them, so now... There y'all go.
He's taken care of guinea hens out here, monarch butterflies, you name it. And this deep love of animals emerged when Rodney was just a boy, growing up in Southeast, one of the roughest patches of Washington, D.C.
Anytime I see an animal, period, I mean, far back as I can remember, I jump off a bicycle, car, whatever, I'm going to the animal. It's no one animal, all right? It's animals, mice, chickens, rabbits, snake, squirrel. It's animals, period. I'm addicted to animals.
That addiction ran deep. Whenever he came across an animal that was hurt, Rodney felt compelled to intervene.
You'll see a bird that maybe flown into a glass or something and broke his wing. So we would take little popsicle sticks and try to put a little splint around the bird's wing and keep him for a week or two. And remarkably, some were able to fly away, some weren't. You'd see a turtle with a cracked shell. So we took like little Elmer's glue until we start seeing its shell trying to heal back up some.
So there was little Rodney, caretaker of the animal kingdom.
When I see people arguing and acting simple, I would see animals showing love. I just gravitated more towards them.
As Rodney grew up, though, a second gravitational force grew in intensity. At age 17, he bought a cheap used car and racked up a bunch of tickets. He needed money, fast. So he turned to what he'd seen his whole life.
I started selling crack cocaine, actually, to pay the tickets and stuff off. Got all the stuff paid off that I had to pay off. But by that time, I'm in the game now. You got clientele now. So you couldn't just quit then. Why would you want to? The money was so plentiful. Then it became the violence with it, because you couldn't sell drugs without having a gun.
This was a dark time for Rodney.
If I'm coming after you, trust me, you going to Harmony or Fort Lincoln. Those are funeral homes. You're going to be buried at one.
It wasn't just talk. Rodney earned a lethal reputation for good reason. And then there were the times when, smack in the middle of a drug deal, a bird would streak past, and Rodney would pause the whole transaction.
We had our coke on the table, money on the table, whatever, and say there's a big bay window. And out of that window, I saw a bird fly across and land, a hawk, owl, eagle, whatever. I would get up.
You just get up and look at the bird.
Yeah. So, man, look at that hawk. I'm sitting there like, man, I don't know exactly what kind, though. I just know that it's a hawk.
Once the bird flew off, Rodney would wrap the deal, take the money, and head back into the darkness. I told you, fierce thundercloud, soft lining. This is how I picture Rodney's heart, as a ball of two birds, a dove and a hawk. The dove wrapping its wings around the animals in Rodney's world, the hawk flashing its talons at the people. Now, during this time, Rodney needed proof of legitimate income for an apartment he wanted to move into, which is how he found his way to the Earth Conservation Corps.
It was a nonprofit that was set up to give inner city youth a chance to reclaim their community, their environment, and their lives. That's the mission statement, I believe it was.
Rodney continued dealing drugs, but he was spending 40 hours a week hauling trash and car engines out of a tributary that feeds the Anacostia River.
We started breaking stuff down and moving these tires and water starting to flow and everything, and the life of the creek itself exploded. Sun beaming through now, clean water, animals in here, and we were like, wow. I mean, of all the ugliness that I caused, and to be a part of something that brings life back, that brings beauty back, I don't care who you are, you can't fight it.
And it was with this same organization a few years later that Rodney had a moment that came to define who he would become.
She's so... Really?
Mm-hmm.
I can touch her chest?
Mm-hmm.
She's so beautiful, so soft.
Yeah. That's my baby here.
This is Harriet, a regal-looking Harris hawk. Feathers that look as though they've been coated in chocolate and dusted in cinnamon. As for what makes Harriet special, with the help of an animal caretaker standing by, she was the first bird that flew to Rodney and landed on his gloved hand.
I was higher than any drug could ever put you on. No space shuttle has ever flown this high. To see this bird take off, and I mean no cord, no nothing, it can go wherever it wanted to go, came to me.
This connection crackled through Rodney. He had found his ultimate way of bonding with nature, and this personal form of biophilia took powerful root inside of him. He started working with raptors and training them. He began phasing the drug dealing out of his life, but at age 31, the police caught up with Rodney and put him away for 5 months for possession of marijuana with intent to sell. Towards the end of his sentence, he got outside on occasion.
Up there, man, I used to just sit out on a bench and watch the hawks and the eagles fly over. You would forget you're in jail.
These birds that Rodney saw, flying free while he was locked up in a cage, he took them as a sign.
Remember this? This is forever. This make you happy.
And just like that, the dove inside Rodney's chest was able to show the hawk a different way forward. So once he got out of jail, Rodney left his old life behind.
I said I was going to be a falconer. A white guy told me, black guys don't fly birds, y'all eat them. I said, okay. Year and a half later, I saw the same guy. He said, man, you know, I was joking. I said, well, I wasn't. I'm a licensed falconer now.
Now, every day, Rodney, age 44, practices falconry, which involves exercising birds of prey, feeding them, working with them to hunt small animals. He does it at home, where he's got 5 birds, and here, at the Earth Conservation Corps building in Washington, D.C., where there are 2 birds, all of them raptors.
A raptor has 3 characteristics: binocular vision, the curved beak, and they must catch their food with their talons.
It's time for Skye to eat. She's a red-tailed hawk with a banged-up wing. She's non-releasable, like many of the birds Rodney works with. But he's not the one feeding Skye in the aviary today. It's Anthony Satterthwaite, Rodney's apprentice, who's holding the dead mouse.
This is the most aggressive bird that we have, so... because she come right at you.
Yeah.
Just got to be ready and prepared.
Skye flies straight for Anthony's glove, while Rodney watches from the side.
There you go, Aunt. That's exactly it, right there. Let her go, let her go. Just let her hop back up there again. She gonna turn around, she gonna come back to you.
It was just this year that Anthony found the courage to work with raptors.
My worst fear is having one of them birds to grab my face. If it wasn't for Rodney, I wouldn't be going in Skye cage. And I'm 6 feet, 295.
Anthony's reluctance is the norm. Out of the couple thousand falconers in this country, no more than 30 are black.
Black people do not like to be around something that can hurt them. We don't need to be in a situation where this bird could scratch me up to feel the adrenaline rush. Like, we get our adrenaline rush when the police pull us over. It's already tough enough being black.
This is one reason why Rodney's become such a memorable man.
If you see a black guy with a hawk or a falcon on their arm, that's automatically going to get attention.
And Rodney uses that to his advantage these days. He runs the Raptor program for the Earth Conservation Corps and another group called Wings Over America. He's also the CEO and founder of a project called Rodney's Raptors. He takes his birds to after-school programs, prisons, juvenile detention centers. The birds are his gateway to young people who grew up like he did.
Young, black, living in a ghetto. And that bird definitely is your foot in any door. I don't care where I go. Rich people, poor people, don't matter. White, black, Puerto Rican, don't. Pull out that bird. Breaks every color, every barrier that you can possibly put in front of it. That bird gonna break it down.
Take Hollis Wright, a 29-year-old who calls Rodney his uncle. Rodney's been a mentor and friend to Hollis for nearly a decade.
I can call on him for advice, just to calm me down, you know, kind of walk me through certain scenarios. Anything from job applications or paperwork to putting the gun down and getting myself together before I make a terrible mistake and land in jail.
Do the birds that Rodney works with and the young people that Rodney works with, do they have anything in common?
In my personal opinion, they're both kind of damaged goods.
Hollis says that Rodney's first step in forming a connection is to acknowledge that damage and then, very slowly, to build trust.
I wasn't brought up to believe in trust. It was like a unicorn. To trust someone was giving them the opportunity to kind of screw you over.
It took a year, but Rodney became the first person that Hollis ever trusted. Rodney told me another story about a teenager he was working with recently. When Rodney said he was proud of him, the kid just froze and welled up with tears.
Say, man, nobody has ever said that to me.
Day after day, this is the kind of difference Rodney Stotts is making. He's roaming the same streets he prowled as a young man, and he's got a reputation, just like before.
I got people who don't know my name. Birdman, that's the Birdman, that's the Birdman. No, my name is Rodney. I have birds. I'm not the Birdman. I'm not half bird, half man. That's all they know.
It's okay. Rodney Stotts knows who he is. He's just a man teaching others to fly.
And that story, produced by Ari Daniel, is part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Here at Word of Mouth, our business strategy is pretty straightforward. Our bottom line is based on the value we bring to you through off-the-beaten-track stories, ideas bubbling up in our culture, and a little break from the news of the day. Here's your part. You kick back a little so we can keep bringing you high-quality radio 24 hours a day. It's NHPR's March Fund Drive, a great time to show your support.